This is TVLPod.com, The Week in Georgia in English, coming to you from our sunny and beautiful Rustavelli Avenue studios. Today is Thursday, the 4th of July, 2013. On this date, in 1636, the city of Providence, Rhode Island is founded. 1802, the United States Military Academy opens in West Point, New York. In 1827, slavery is abolished in New York State. 1865, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is published. 1918, Bolsheviks kill Tsar Nicholas II of Russia and his family. 1950, the first broadcast by Radio Free Europe. 1966, U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson signs the Freedom of Information Act into law. 1987, Soviets rock for peace with Santana, the Doobie Brothers, and Bonnie Raitt at a concert with 25,000 people. 2012, the Higgs boson thing is discovered at the Large Hadron Collider and is announced at CERN. 5 years ago today, U.S. Senator from North Carolina Jesse Helms, destroyer of the U.S. Information Agency, died. Birthdays today are the fantastic French writer Sébastien Japrisot, Italian butt-kicker Giuseppe Garibaldi, contraption guy Rube Goldberg, writer Nathaniel Hawthorne and Neil Simon, twins Ann Landers and Dear Abby, singer Bill Withers, first daughter Malia Obama, poem Guram Urceulishvili, and the United States of America. We are Matthias Hooter and me, Mark Mulling. Nothing we say can be connected with any of our employers, past, present, or future. Thanks for those posting on the forum. To comment, ask for an opinion, or follow up, go to tvlpod.com or send us an email at tvlpod@gmail.com. My Georgian Journal and Fides Politra column this week is about apologies and how the general disinclination to make them in Georgia are influencing Georgian politics right now, and the consequences of that. The national movement is splitting into those groups that are thinking about making an apology and those individuals that are not. And if you could divide the Otsneva people, it would be into the groups that are cackling wildly at the vengeance that they're enjoying right now, and those that would prefer to just move on in the right circumstances. On the 2nd of July, Irakli Vekoa, Georgia's foreign ministry spokesman, announced that Georgia has revoked visa-free entry for Iranians because of concerns that Iranians are trying to skirt international sanctions. Georgia and Iran agreed on visa-free travel for short visits in 2010. The head of the Commerce and Industry Chamber of Iran, Said Babai, who headed a delegation of Iranian businessmen to Georgia, stated that it is necessary that the economy be separated from politics. Babai stated that, quote, those Western countries that set certain limits on Iran will sooner or later realize that a refusal to cooperate with Iran in the economic sphere may be harmful to them, end quote.
So do you know what the new visa regime is now? Like, if an Iranian family wants to come here for vacation, do they need to buy a visa at the Armenian-Georgian border, or do they need to apply long in advance at the embassy in Tehran?
We do not know. I certainly don't know. My impression is that this is all motivated, sadly, by the Rupert Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal, which published an article that was pretty alarmist about how Georgia's the new money laundering haven, which is not really accurate, certainly compared to Istanbul or Dubai.
Or Cyprus,
or practically anywhere else, or London, or Vienna, by that matter. They said in there that there were all these businesses that were being registered by Republican Guard people. What they didn't mention was that in order to get a residence card, you had to register a business, and so I don't know. That just created a sort of freak out more by from what I've heard, more by the Georgian government than, you know, some sort of official U.S. demarche about sanctions or something like that.
But some of the examples also seem, I mean, at least to me, they seem like legitimate businesses, like Fly Georgia, that is an airline, new startup airline owned by Iranians. I mean, that's not,
right.
It doesn't appear to be a money laundering enterprise.
The way the sanctions are written of OFAC, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, is essentially to encourage people to freak out. The burden of proof is on whoever's doing the business. So In any case, I mean, okay, there are plenty of, you know, of state-sponsored Iranian baddies floating around and, you know, whatever else. I think mainly this was just a relatively ill-considered move, particularly during this big business, summit event where they had
the start of the tourist season.
Yeah, just the whole thing was unwise and illustrates a lack of coordination in the government on figuring these things out. On the 1st of July, Misha's administration announced that presidential elections would be held on Sunday, the 27th of October, but later the head of the president's administration, Andro Barnov, said that the date was changed to the 31st of October due to a technical mistake. Then it went back, and it went back and forth. Some NGOs had some issues with that, and I don't know. Now it seems to be the 27th. Yesterday, on 3rd July, after meeting with representatives from NGOs, Barnaby announced that the elections will go back to the original date, the 27th of October. Election code states that after the date is announced, the candidates may begin preparing to canvass. A candidate must submit at least 26,530 supporting signatures to be on the ballot. Several candidates have already been announced. Of course, Tbilpod.com's favorite, Shalvan Atalashvili from the Labor Istebi Party.
Are we going to do an official endorsement?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we are. We'll have to vote on it. You okay with it?
Okay, fine.
Okay, so Tbilpod.com has officially supported the candidacy of Shalvan Atalashvili. Not that we wanted to be president, but we support his candidacy above all others.
For entertainment value,
yes. Leader of the Democratic Movement United Georgia nominee Nino Bourgenadze, although for entertainment value, she's given Shalva a run for her money. Georgian Dream nominated Education Minister Georgi Mark Velashvili. On a related note, MP and leader of the parliamentary majority, Dato Saganalidze, will run Marginashvili's campaign. Listeners can't see this, but my eyebrows seem to have raised themselves at this news. UNM intends to nominate its candidate after primaries, which will finish the end of July. In case you have been living in a cave for several years, according to the Constitution, Misha, who has served two presidential terms, cannot run for a third term. The candidates in the primary are Dato Bakratze, Zurab Japaridze, Gia Baramidze, and Shota Malashkhia. Former parliamentary speaker Dato Bakradze won the first primary that was held in Kutaisi. Kartuli Dasi, Jondi Bagaturia, said that Pata Burchiladze, the famous Georgian singer and founder of the charity fund Ivnana, will announce whether or not he will run for president after the 9th of July. Leader of the Christian Democratic Movement, Georgi Targamadze, said that they will name their presidential candidate within 2 weeks.
Do you want to elaborate on why your eyebrows moved at the mentioning of Dato
Saganalidze? I don't know. They just moved themselves. Dato Saganalidze, not known for being the most progressive character in the Georgian parliament, xenophobic, homophobic, a little befuddled. But you got to have somebody run your campaign. So let's see how that works out for the Minister of Education. On the 27th of June, the investigative service of the Finance Ministry detained 22 employees of Tbilisi City Hall and the Tbilisi City Council. They were released that evening, though four were later detained again. After the initial detentions, the investigative service claimed the individuals were not in fact detained, but only questioned. However, the detainees disputed this, saying that no one asked them to give testimony and they were treated like criminals because they were handcuffed during the detention. Later that same day, the investigative service of the Finance Ministry issued a statement accusing Tbilisi City Hall officials of organizing and supporting crime by misappropriating more than $30 million from Tbilisi's rehabilitation fund. At night, the investigation service issued another statement and again detained four officials. Deputy Mayor of Tbilisi, Dato Alavidze, Head of Tbilisi Development Fund, Dato Albaliani, Head of the City Hall's Purchasing Service, Alexei Tabuashvili, and Deputy Gam Gebeli of Kurtsanisi District, Dmitry Chheidze. They are accused of embezzling and misappropriating this $30 million. According to the statement, another person, Georgi Sabanadze, former director of Tbilisi's Development Fund, is hiding. On the 1st of July, the Rustavi City Court sentenced all four to pretrial detention. If convicted, the City Hall officials may face from 7 to 11 years in jail.
And the fact that this whole thing is managed by the Rustavi City court has, you know, raised some questions. And the prosecutor has said that, yeah, the accused expressed their mistrust towards the Tbilisi-based investigators, and that's why we had to move it to Rustavi and have the courts there deal with it. Other people speculate that it might be easier for the government to kind of keep a control over the procedures in Rustavi than in Tbilisi. But that was a bit strange. Also, the handcuffing thing was very questionable. At first, people were questioned, but led away in handcuffs. And then that was apparently a clear violation of the procedures and should not have happened, as I think there are a lot of questionable things in how the government has proceeded with these investigations and the questioning in these cases.
Well, the whole thing started during this, you know, big, very important NATO summit. Now, of course, I'm not saying that, you know, everybody shouldn't pretend that all of these prosecutions and investigations aren't completely independent and unrelated to politics. But essentially what happened is everybody just forgot about the optics of having these arrests that were, in fact, just questionings. All of this, by the way, was done by the financial police, not by the prosecutor's office. And so, you know, the prosecutor, as it pulls in all of these former officials, is getting a little bit more practiced, whereas the financial police don't seem to...
Still in the old mode of...
still in the, like, well, okay, go get them, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, total Keystone Cops operation. And first of all, it looked bad and makes Georgia look stupid and discombobulated to the international community. It fits very, very comfortably into the narrative that legislators around Western Europe, like the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly and a few members of Congress, this narrative of, you know, all these politically motivated arrests. Right. And the whole conversation, like on this podcast, is about the procedures, not on the disappearing 30 million lari, which the hardest working NGO, Transparency International Georgia, had been talking about for some time, even before the elections.
Before the elections. I mean, forever, the Tbilisi City Hall has been a very, at times, opaque organization. There has been lots of dodgy documented procurement deals going on there with, like, former deputy mayors winning, you know, ridiculous contracts to plant trees for ridiculous amounts of money, for example. But also they had these huge funds to renovate the old town or different neighborhoods in Tbilisi, and none of these contracts were tendered in any public way. None of the spending was supervised by anybody. It was not documented for the public at all. So there have been lots of questionable things going on at the municipality for a long time. But on the other hand, I mean, at the same time, I'm wondering, in Georgia, you end up in pretrial detention very quickly. I'm not a criminal lawyer, but in other countries, or in some other countries, I guess, if you're accused of, especially a white-collar crime, if you don't pose an obvious threat to the public, you know, like, they take away your passport and make sure you don't leave the country, but...
Yeah,
and you just walk until you're found guilty.
Yeah, it's really pretty easy for them to make sure you don't leave the country with a passport. And I think that the flight risk is relatively modest. This intimidation of witnesses, I think, is I don't know. I mean, okay, I guess you could make an argument with Vano Medabashvili, but with these people, I'm not really sure. And, in the end, I think that the argument that a lot of the current government officials make is that, oh, well, you know, we have the public clamoring for punishment. I'm not sure I really buy that. I mean, you know, if you're going to obey the law, that's fine. Don't listen to the clamoring public. I mean, if the clamoring public are braying for public executions, you know, then I don't know that that route is the one to go. Anyway, this is a gigantic mess, and it will be interesting to see what happens now, and whether or not the fact that this was messed up will influence the case at all, or whether they will plow right ahead with this embezzlement case and ignore the fact that they completely blew its start. On the 1st of July, Tbilisi City Council Chairman Kochi Ionatamishvili made a statement that he is leaving UNM and that UNM no longer is in the majority in the City Council. In response, Misha's administration made public a letter that he wrote in which he asked Misha for assistance with businesses he owns. Quote, "I could never imagine that I would address you with such a private request. I have a problem. I have a lot of debts, and I dared to ask you to mediate with some businessmen. I have a share in one of the businesses and cannot sell it. If you could help me sell this share, it would be a rescue for me." He, Nona Tamishvili's letter said.
But I think the letter is from 2008 or something, or 2009, so it's an old letter.
An important question. All right. According to him, he's owner of a 2% share in Sabertalo 2007 company. Quote, "I want to sell the share for $100,000.
Must be a very profitable company. And end you can quote. Sell 2% of Sabertalo 2007 for $100,000.
He said this in the letter to Misha. After the letter was made public, Inona Tamishvili made another statement saying he had written a letter, but the content was different, and he called on other UNM members to leave the party, describing Misha as disgusting.
I think this was probably the last municipality where the UNM had a majority. Where I can't think of any other areas where the UNM now still has like some role to play other than the president.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, something to think about. The number of prisoners in penitentiary facilities has decreased 60% compared to the beginning of July 2012. The prison ministry stated that there are 9,373 convicts currently in prison. On the 1st of July, Data Akhalaya, former head of CUDI, was charged in absentia for abuse of power, for organizing torture, abusing his official position, and for illegal deprivation of liberty. Akhalaya's whereabouts remain unknown. All everybody says Istanbul. He disappeared after the election in October of last year. On the 2nd of December 2012, he was first charged in Sandro Girvliani's murder case. On the 2nd of July, approximately 150 women serving prison sentences in Rustavi Penitentiary Facility No. 5 went on hunger strike, demanding that their terms be shortened. The female prisoners appealed to the chairman of the Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights, Eka Beselia, for assistance. They demanded their case be reviewed and that their terms be halved. In addition, they seek to meet the deputy chairman of the Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights, Gedevan Popkhadze. According to an IRI study on the public perception of the government's achievements, the distribution of agricultural cards is perceived as the main achievement of the Georgian dream.
So these were kind of vouchers that were given to subsistence farmers. Yeah. Not a big policy achievement, I would say. It's nothing that would really improve sustainability of agricultural development.
I mean, hey, if you're looking for popular policy, it's hard to do better than handing out cash, you know. And cash distribution as a policy choice, made famous by Brazil and a few others, you know, there are a lot of development theorists who say it's a good idea.
This was not cash. This was vouchers for, you know, fertilizers and for pesticides.
Right, that you could sell to, you know, get cash, which I'm guessing happened. The second achievement is the reduction of utility bills, and the third is agricultural reform. According to another IRI poll, 82% of Georgians are in favor of restoring relations with Russia, while 11% said that relations should be partially reinstated. A third survey relating to newspapers indicates that the most trustworthy and regularly read Georgian newspaper is Kvitis Palitra, in which I appear weekly.
Think you were the main reason why people trust the newspaper? Because of
Are you questioning that that's the reason people read? Why else would you read Fides Politra? All those other goofy columnists. 17% of respondents saying that they trusted and regularly read it, especially because... No, not really. Asavalda Savaldi, welcome. All right, well... Okay, pay no attention to everything we just said. Asaf Aldo Savaldi received 8% of their support. Alia, 3%. Kronika, 2%. Resonansi, 2%. Akhalita Uba, 2%. And Guria News, a regional paper. Nice job, Guria News. 1%. The newspaper that I have not ever heard so much about. Kronika Plus.
Well, now, there's Kronika, apparently, and then there's, you know, the
Kronika, Kronika Plus. Okay. Yeah, I haven't really heard so much about. And this is, okay, this is kind of a little story, but because it involves people here, you know, that we know and have even been on the show, I'm going to read the whole thing. But we have no idea where any of this stuff comes from. I communicated with some of them, and they're not really so sure where this comes from. But we figure we got to read it anyway, especially because I have a special personal interest in individuals from the Shevardnadze era resurfacing, of which several of them are. Anyway, Kronika Plus published an article about BI and businessman Vanoch Kartashvili's supposed secret agreement. Kartashvili was Minister of Economy under Shevardnadze from 2000 to 2001. Later, he was a member of Parliament. He's now a wealthy businessman, very wealthy, based in London. According to the article, BI and Kartashvili founded an international charity fund called Media House in the UK. Members of the fund's initiative group were journalist Irakli Imnaishvili, Natia Abramia of the BBC, Vahran Komachidze, kind of nutty investigative journalist, Nino Toradze, sister of the famous piano player, Badri Bebia, and owner of Caucasus Network, Mamia Sanadiradze. Abramia is alleged to be
Caucasus Online. That's what Caucasus Network
means. Caucasus Online. Abramia is alleged to be the head of the organization. Following organizations and individuals were on the fund's council, Reporters Without Borders, Rolu Rec Trust, Tom Duvall, Vera Vajache Freiberg, Donald Rayfield, and Freedom House.
And I think at this point you can see that the whole story
might not be thoroughly researched or completely on the ball here, you know. But hey, this is Stabilpod.com, and like all responsible Georgian journalists, we completely ignore source or responsibility for anything. The fund aimed to support free media and journalists, improve relations with the Georgian diaspora, and publish free newspapers. No information about the fund's grants, activities, or projects are known. According to the article, Kartashvili's daughter sold Mzera TV to three people: Georgian poet Dato Magradze, Irakli Kordzaya, who works as head of the prison ministry's international relations department, and Dachi Saguria, who is a PR manager of the railways. December 2012, Lasha Zhvanya, who's now head of Ilya II's fund, sent Kartashvili a, quote, secret letter, end quote, on behalf of the organization Global Mediation Georgia, and suggested that Kartashvili start negotiating with the Patrikatsvili family about the property two are arguing over. No further details about the negotiations are known.
I mean, I think this piece is not very enlightening. Basically, what checks out is that Kartashvili in February of last year set up a UK entity called Georgia Media House Georgia Limited, and hired a few people to do, with the goal of doing PR for him in Georgia, describing him as a good guy, and with the long-term goal of him getting back in ZTV. So then they set up this online TV station called Zera TV that was then shut down around the elections again, and I think the whole enterprise was shut down in the past few months. Because now Kartashvili, I think he seems to have like a fairly functioning working relationship with Bidzina, and so I think he's trusting that he has different channels to get his ZTV back.
Uh-huh. Okay. Ministry of Education stated that in September, the salaries of public school principals, as well as administrative and technical staff, will be increased by 40 to 45%. The average monthly salary of school principals can be as high as 460 lari, while starting in September, it should reach 600 lari. The average salaries of assistant principals will increase from 335 lari to 400 lari. Teacher salaries are pretty low. No news as to whether those are going to increase. School directors, and the fact that there's more discussion or more increases going to school directors than teachers is important. And I think, you know, traditionally in Soviet schools, there were these super powerful school directors that really sort of often would run the school as mafias. And I think the fact that the Ministry of Education is increasing those salaries while not talking about teachers is a little dangerous. But anyway, any moves in education are worthwhile. By the way, there's going to be a new educational concept or strategic plan that UNICEF itself, meaning the education ministry, out with that that should be worth watching. Ministry of Health has announced that the general insurance package has expanded as of the 1st of July, meaning it will now cover expenses related to planned hospital visits in addition to the other three components, planned outpatient visits, emergency outpatient visits, and emergency hospital visits.
Well, basically, what the government has promised in the campaign was that healthcare for everybody. And now they have, on paper, I think at least, expanded healthcare coverage to from old people and very poor people who before had government subsidized health insurance packages to other people that were like in the middle but couldn't still afford to get healthcare. In practice, I think it has been a very messy process, the introduction of these programs, and nobody really knew what was going on, so the insurance companies were kind of, you know, didn't really know what was happening, hospital operators. And the general public, I think, was left without much information about what is now happening and what is now in place. So I would be interested in hearing, you know, what this change actually means for the lower middle class people, the people in the countryside who couldn't buy the private healthcare insurance packages before. Can they now get government-subsidized packages, and what is in these packages?
And another question is those who are involved in the business of medicine and hospitals, that there was, you know, the previous government, I don't know much about the details, but my impression from talking to them was their attitude was just privatize everything and somehow it'll get sorted out. And I think that they handed out some cash along the way, but a lot of businesses, some of them close to the government, but many of them not, and some of them international, ended up buying hospitals. And I wonder how this...
Or building hospitals. They were basically coerced or gently pressured into building and renovating hospitals, and in exchange they would get for that region the kind of monopoly on providing the services. So the government would pay them, and in that region the company would then be able to, you know, cater to all the pensioners and poor people and treat them in a hospital that the government would pay the bill for that.
So it'd be interesting to hear what you know, how they feel about this and what these changes mean for them, and whether they feel they're ever going to be able to recoup their gently coerced investments. Itar Tass reported that the Deputy State Minister for Reintegration, Ketevan Tsikalashvili, said that Russian citizen and French cinematic star Gerard Depardieu violated Georgian law by entering Abkhazia from the Russian Federation. According to the article, on the 1st of July, Depardieu visited Sukhumi and met with Abkhaz President Alexander Ankvab. Depardieu said he had learned about Abkhazia when he met with the late President Sergei Bagapsh in St. Petersburg and decided to visit the country. Wow. In one of the country's biggest espionage cases since the Cold War, a German court has jailed a married couple for spying on behalf of the Russian Secret Service for the last 20 years. The pair, identified only by the code names Andreas and Heidrun Anschlag, were planted in what was then West Germany in 1988 by the Soviet Union's KGB. They later worked for its successor, the SVR. The husband was jailed for 6.5 years, while his wife was given 5.5 years. Prosecutors reportedly allege that the couple met an official, Raymond Potrai, up to 30 times between 2008 and 2011 and paid him more than 72,000 euros for documents. The documents included sensitive political and military information on NATO and the EU's activity in Afghanistan and Georgia. I don't know what the EU and NATO were actually doing in Georgia, but, you know, we'll see. I don't know, maybe they actually got their hands on the EUMM reports about what's, you know, going on along the, you know, the border. I mean the administrative thing. U.S. House of Representatives adopted a statement about the Georgian government's recent arrests into larger defense bill H.R. 1960. The section reads, quote, "The measures taken by the Georgian government against former officials and political opponents, apparently in part motivated by political considerations, may have a significant negative impact on cooperation between the United States and Georgia, including efforts to build a stronger relationship in political, economic, and security matters, as well as progress on integrating Georgia into international organizations." It goes on to say, the United States must be unambiguous when democratic backsliding occurs in a key ally after a peaceful and democratic transfer of power between political parties. End quote. Yeah, you know, this is just really stupid. And there's several different stupid things about this. First of all, to say that...
It's the U.S. House of Representatives.
I know, it's a bunch of Republican chowderheads, but you know, for them to say that the United States has to be unambiguous when there's democratic backsliding going on, I mean, there's not been a congressional delegation here since the election, so it's not like these guys really have much of a clue as to what they're talking about. Also, call me crazy, and I don't want to sound Bidzina-like, but, you know, I suspect that those individuals in the former government who, you know, have strong connections in Washington had a, you know, serious hand to play in this. And I think the biggest stupidity in this is, okay, fine, I mean, a bunch of Republican chowderheads can toss off some, you know, one-liner in paragraph 4 quadrillion in the defense bill or whatever else, but... is that those individuals in the national movement seem to be expending so much effort in getting various parliaments, congresses, and parliamentary assemblies to stick some tiny little one-liner in there when it does absolutely nothing. All it does is just annoy the current government and achieves absolutely zero. And their efforts could really be better spent elsewhere, in my view. On the 26th of June, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of T.I. George's client who was trying to register property rights over a land plot. In December 2012, this legal entity applied to the public registry as the law stipulated. The deadline for requesting recognition of property was the end of 2012. However, the public registry didn't look over the documents until after the new year, meaning the legal entity was unable to register the property. T.I. fought the case and won.
So I think this could be, it might be a first case out of many where people, after the elections, actually have their property rights respected or reinstated. There are still hundreds, if not thousands, of cases where individuals had their land plots taken away from them because the government wanted to build something, a hotel or a highway, or sell it to investors who often happen to be members of parliament or people closely linked to the government. And people just had their rights violated. And there was no way to go through the court and get justice in the court because the courts were so politicized and always basically found a way to rule in favor of the government. And now we might see more and more of these cases being resolved by the court. But the new government has been very reluctant to touch that because it would often mean the government having to pay compensation to somebody, and that would cost a lot of cash that the government doesn't have.
Yeah, I mean, at least in these cases, it should be remembered that there is a potential plaintiff. I mean, there's somebody whose land was taken, and it can be restored. There's a lot of other cases, and I'm curious as to what will happen with those where, you know, for example, restaurants were built by government officials who were handed for one lottie chunks of public parks, or other public spaces that have been, you know, that have been taken over by officials, where there's no obvious plaintiff in cases like those. On the 28th of June, locals attacked and beat the wife of a Muslim prayer leader in the village of Samtatskaro. Police went to the house which Muslims used to pray. After a peaceful Friday prayer, the police left. Then the locals went to the prayer leader's house and attacked his wife, warning the rest of the Muslims to leave the village. Locals had earlier prevented Muslims from conducting Friday prayers for 3 weeks, but a government minister has intervened, although, as far as I know, there have been no arrests, no pretrial detentions, no nothing.
There have been NGOs going there to monitor the Friday prayers. But this is a small village in Kakheti where I think a bunch of people from Ajara decades ago were moved there as kind of like their village was, you know, like there were mudslides or something like that. So they were moved to Kakheti. They've been there for forever. And now in the past couple of months, there were basically every Friday people who wanted to pray in somebody's house were prevented by kind of the majority, the radical kind of... you know, a group of radical Orthodox Christians were prevented from conducting their prayer, and it has escalated basically from week to week. The government hasn't done anything to really, you know, like kind of arrest these that threaten others or that.
Yeah, this is just is just appalling that there has not been a high level visit out there by some significant figure to say, listen, cool it, just back off, and that's what we're about.
Went there last week.
But that's not senior enough. We need we need Khadibashvili saying heads are going to roll, or or Bidzina to go out there and say this is not how we roll. I don't know. It's really too. This has been in the news for a long time. This has been going on for.
This seems to be a very easy case where the government could clearly show its commitment. We protect minority rights, and we are.
Yeah, and by
we're
the
making an effort,
so what they're doing by not going there, where it's not like it's not difficult to get to, it's not far away. By not doing this, they are essentially saying that we're totally okay with with Orthodox wackos beating up people who they disagree with. Three carts, amber jewelry, and seven mummified bodies were found in Ananuri. These are from the early Bronze Age, according to Zurab Maharadze, the head of the archaeological expedition. It's really old, evidently something like, 5,000 BC or something like that. It was some kind of small ziggurat. It had been raided before, but they still found some jewelry and stuff. It really sounds like quite a significant find. Ministry of Internal Affairs launched a new social campaign under the slogan "Don't drive when drunk." The ministry is prudently holding a contest for the best slogan to replace that one, the best design, and the best photo relating to this topic. All you've got to do is upload your submission to the ministry's Facebook page, which is facebook.com/MIAofGEO. The winner will be decided based on the number of likes. The best slogan, design, and photo will be put up on billboards around Tbilisi. The contest ends the 11th of July. And also, don't drive when drunk.
Well, don't drink and drive. I mean, drunk is a thing that is, I think, fairly subjective.
yeah, exactly.
Like somebody, after a Supra, three bottles of wine later, I'm
not drunk. No. Yeah, exactly. Good thinking. On Thursday, the 27th of June, the Uniform National Examination begins. This year, the 30% grant has been annulled. There will only be 70 and 50% grants to higher education institutions for those who do well on the exams. 15 speed radars were installed along the central streets in Tbilisi. According to the patrol police, speed limits will be increased from 60 to 70 kilometers per hour, but not on Vajav Shodela.
Seriously, in the city, 70 kilometers?
Yeah, which is incredibly high and really, really terrible. Not to mention the fact that it's broken all the time. I mean, constantly on Rustaveli, there are cars going down Rustaveli Avenue at, over 100 kilometers an hour. And none of them ever seem to get tickets, at least as far as I've seen. I spent a lot of time on Rustaveli and never, ever have seen anyone getting a ticket. Konstantin Mosidze, the son of Lali Egadze, one of the owners of TV3, formerly Real TV, is going to...
It was like a Ministry of Interior outlet.
Right.
Put up for propaganda purposes ahead of the 2010 local elections and then kind of sustained until the elections in October.
He is going to open a new TV company. The Georgian National Communications Commission has allowed TV8 to obtain a satellite broadcasting license after they paid the 2,000 lari licensing fee. Mosidze said that they haven't yet decided what kind of broadcasting company they will offer viewers.
Anybody can get a satellite license in Georgia. That's kind of an administrative thing. Even you could get one and have to build pop played, in a loop over there on some satellite TV channels with a picture of you in the background.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It's 2,000 lari for the license and then maybe $10,000 a month for the feed uplink to a satellite, but that's it. So
that sounds kind of exciting. And how many households would that reach in Georgia?
Like maybe 20-25% that have a satellite dish.
And is with the changeover from analog to digital, is that going to increase or anything? Interesting.
Well, when we have digital terrestrial TV, and hopefully 2 years from now, you can buy yourself, you know, a terrestrial TV channel slot for, you know, I don't know, $20,000, $30,000. So
interesting. Something to think about.
Start saving now.
All of our fans, you know, if you'd be interested in seeing an endless Bealpod loop on channel 463 on your cable package, let us know. Here's a quote from Mr. Mosidze. Quote, I have decided to found a television because Georgia currently doesn't have a television that satisfies the requirements of the viewers. For the moment, I haven't decided what exactly my television will be. End quote. He currently studies at Caucasus University. Georgian Dream MP Kobe Davitashvili and one of the many unofficial Tbilpod.com mascots has suggested the government introduce restrictions on TV series and other TV programs which contain, quote, propaganda of violence or homosexual, bisexual, and polygamous relations, end quote. You know, like the Bible. The irony, of course, is that Davitashvili himself got into a fist fight on live television with UNMP Sergo Ratiani.
It was like a couple of months ago.
Yeah, not fairly recently. Davitashvili said, quote, I don't want Georgia to become Brazil. That country has its own culture. Georgia has a different culture, end quote.
He also referred to Lithuanian legislation that he had studied very hard and that he found to ban anything from Brazilian soap operas to anything that is remotely stimulating homosexual behavior, which I'm pretty sure is completely made up.
Yeah, and he's the head of the Estonian Georgian Friendship Association. Is the official patron. So I wonder what the Baltic connection is. Maybe this is Estonian propaganda or something.
Yeah. But basically, I think it resembles a law that Russia just passed, which basically makes it illegal to discuss anything, you know, that would be seen as supporting homosexual or indecent behavior in public. I don't know. It would be interesting to see how many crazy supporters he gets in the parliament. He is a member of the Georgian Dream, so but he has had other ideas that were shut down. He wanted to ban gambling, which is actually like
not a bad idea. I mean, especially internet gambling, or at least to regulate it more effectively.
Right, but I mean, this is clearly something that Georgia that violates any international human rights commitments that Georgia has signed up to.
So then the other thing that, of course, he is known for is the very first bill that showed up in the new parliament, which was to ban the sale of condoms in places where things are sold that children might want, close to schools or something. Yeah, I don't know. It was just unbelievably
goofy. Davitashvili is an interesting character, right? He used to be close to Misha, I think.
That's right.
And kidnapped at least once.
Yeah, his son and Misha's are, you know, they've switched godfatherness. And he was sort of, after Vanametovich, really the second guy that sort of joined, you know, Misha as a political force around, must have been 2001, something like that, 2001. And then he sort of went off into left field. The National Film Center, together with the Ministry of Culture, is going to restore municipal cinemas. The ministry bought 5 film projectors to be put in Tel Aviv, Poti, Hulo, Martvili, and Gori. This is a very, very cool initiative. We will follow up. We'd be interested to hear from any listeners in Tel Aviv, Poti, Hulo, Martvili, and Gori about when those open up and what kind of things
they
show.
If they really open up.
If they really open up.
Just the local governor has a new projector in his home.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Pegasus Airlines launched flights from Tbilisi to Athens. These flights will occur daily. The cost of a one-way ticket range from 129 to 200 euros. Wizz Air Ukraine started flights from Kharkov or Kharkiv, depending on your politics, to Kutaisi. These regular flights will occur twice a week. The average cost of a one-way ticket is 40 euros.
Any experiences out there from flying in and out of Kutaisi? I would be interested in, you know, for tourism.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard, I talked to one person that said it was great. They were very happy with the situation. So, and it's really, you know, It's only 3 hours to Kutaisi. I mean, I think that there are, you know, the economics of this could work out well for a lot of people. So please let us know, anyone who has flown Wizz Air Ukraine in and out of Kutaisi. On the 1st of July, the Feast of Peter and Paul began. The fast lasts for 12 days and is celebrated, it'll end on the 12th of July. The fast is not strict compared to others, so fish is allowed.
And beer? Is beer allowed?
I don't know, man. You know, I don't know. I'm not one of those Greek Orthodoxers, so not sure. So, parliamentary news this week. TI Georgia submitted a draft initiative to Parliament which will limit the president and government's use of reserve funds to situations of force majeure, as in the well-known former Prime Minister Zura Nohaideli, back in the day, who came right after Zura Zhvania when he declared spring as force majeure. Anyway, how they would define force majeure, I'm not sure. Meaning that these funds can only be used in unexpected and uncontrollable events. Corresponding amendments should be made to the budget code and the bill on state procurement. TI Georgia also launched myparliament.ge, a new parliamentary monitoring website which enables users to view information about elected MPs as well as the procedural status of laws being considered by Parliament. Also, it allows citizens to directly pose questions to their representatives in Parliament.
Yeah, so if you can basically send a message to, post a message for an MP, and then the MP is encouraged to respond to the citizen's question, and you can, and the communication is visible for everybody, and basically you can see which MPs actually care about, you know, getting back to their constituents and which don't. These are systems that are, in Germany it works very well, but also in a bunch of other European countries, this has become a system where, you know, people become more closely connected to politics and their MPs, and where MPs just like have to make a stronger effort to show that they really care about what their, you know, constituents think.
Great. Well, we will put down some information on the law changes that are changing the fines for speeding and all of these pro-car legislation that is bizarrely coming out of the majoritarian from Spinza. Actually, I don't think he is a majoritarian. I think he ran in Spinza but lost, but was somehow on the list, and he seems to be the one that is sponsoring all of these bills. I mean, NDI did something like this almost 3 years ago or something, but bizarrely, it wasn't for citizens; it was only for NGOs, and so you had to register as an NGO in order to comment supposedly on draft legislation, but nobody ever used it. I mean,
it also provided, I think, basically web space for the majoritarian MPs, but not many people took advantage of
it. I mean, it was just strange that they didn't open it up to the public, and I don't really think it went anywhere. Okay, the Parliament approved amendments to the law concerning ownership of agricultural land. According to the new amendments, foreign natural and legal persons, meaning human beings and companies, are not allowed to buy agricultural land until the 31st of December 2014.
So this is kind of a moratorium?
It's a moratorium, yeah, more than anything else. No restrictions based on the size of land are laid down in the amendments. The law concerns any land having the status of being agricultural. In particular, the Georgian government is to prepare the universal state policy on ownership of agricultural land with the aim of rational exploitation and protection of the land. Besides, the government shall prepare regulations of the fund of agricultural land, the land cadastre, and the universal system of land management.
So the basically what it comes down to is that the government says we don't know how much agricultural land there is in Georgia, we don't know who owns it, and we need some time to figure that out and then build a strategy of, you know, like based on that data, if we want to allow foreigners to own land, if not, or how we regulate that, and that's why they just suspended the sale for the next 1.5 years.
Yeah, it's a very this is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think that's a reasonable amount of time. They the previous government sold a bunch of land to foreign investors.
Also, the current government
and could be. I don't know about that, but I know that like enormous tracts were sold to under the previous government. And the I mean, nothing illegal about it. And I think the logic that they had was quite good. The problem with it was, as is was so often the case with many of their policies, is that it was like, you know, well, let's you know, get it in use and let's, you know, get things moving. But there were lots of people. It was in often depopulated areas or areas that have significantly lower populations now than they did 25 years ago. And so the people who had remained had been using that land, either orchards or pasture or sometimes even planting the land, and had sort of gotten to think of it as theirs. They weren't too exactly certain where the, you know, cadastre lines were and whatever else. And so then somebody shows up who doesn't speak Georgian and looks a little bit different and says, okay, this is my land now. And they'd been using it for, you know, a couple of decades or something. And the former owner was now, you know, outside of the country or in the city or something like that. And it caused a lot of frustration. So one way or another, somebody needs to figure out something about
actually,
that.
Actually, for foreigners, it became only legal to buy the agricultural land about a year ago. There was a constitutional court ruling that lifted a previous ban on foreigners being able to acquire agricultural land. So that was only a window the past year or so. Mm-hmm. But we saw a bunch of Indian investors and some foreigners who have been living here for a long time buying agricultural land and building farms and,
right,
you know.
These restrictions are not applicable to agricultural lands that are already owned by foreign natural or legal persons, meaning human beings or companies. That is, if a foreign owner of agricultural land, he will be able to sell it freely or even give it to another foreigner. Following up on last week's story about the reduction of penalties for traffic violations, MP Temur Maysuradze, who, via myparliament.ge, we will give you some information about Badano Temur, from the Georgian Dream, he is the one who initiated the changes that we talked about last week. He was Georgian Dream's candidate in Aspinza, but lost to UNM's Tadiel Londridze. He is deputy chairman of the faction Georgian Dream National Forum, deputy chairman of the Committee of Sector Economy and Economic Policy, and member of the Agrarian Issues Committee. You can send him a message from Parliament's webpage and express your opinion about the changes. We will make the exact link available on the forum. BBC reporter Rajan Datar met a group of Georgian rappers who look more to the United States than to Russia for inspiration. To see the video of Georgia's young rappers, including one with dreadlocks, check out the forum. BBC has reported that Batumi is gaining a reputation as the Las Vegas of the Black Sea as couples flock to the pretty coastal city to get married. BBC reporter joined a wedding party to see for himself why so many people from afar afield as Italy and the United States are choosing Batumi as the place to get hitched. This, too, will be posted to our forum. I wonder if they have, like, Elvis impersonators doing marriages yet.
The divorce chapel, yeah.
Or maybe, you know, a la Pugachova impersonators doing marriages or something. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. There's a business opportunity there for those.
For the
teach and learn people, you know, hanging around trying to find something to do. Yeah. You know, there you go. If you can impersonate Elvis or somebody and, you know, can set up the divorce chapel. A new report by TI Georgia about the Georgian advertising market entitled The Georgian Advertising Market, Competition at Last? Has just come out and is worth reading.
Yeah, well, we established by looking at the advertising expenditure in the past couple of years that the Georgian economy is not doing that well because advertising spending has been stagnating for a long time. Perceived political instability has really stopped most local and foreign businesses from increasing their marketing spending, which is bad for the media because that's where the money comes from. And if there's less advertising money, then there's more political money and more political bias usually. But at least there's no longer political pressure on businesses, it appears. And so businesses are now giving, you know, advertising money to where they think it has the most impact. So they give it to, you know, critical outlets or government-friendly outlets, while before, basically all the money was flowing only to government-controlled media outlets, which made it extremely hard for anybody who was critical of the government to get any advertising revenue.
An excellent article by Molly Corso titled Georgia, New Government Struggling to Keep Police Reform Pledge was on Eurasianet.org. Another interesting BBC article entitled Georgia's Mighty Orthodox Church. All the stuff to read will be posted on the forum. This week's geocapital number is 83%, which is the percentage of Georgians who think that politicians who don't believe in God are unfit for public office, according to the 2008 World's Values Survey.
Which is also interesting because Bidzina has publicly acknowledged his.
This is especially interesting considering the recent electoral victory of the Georgian Dream Coalition, led by Bidzina Ivanishvili, who in the pre-election period said, quote, "Sometimes they ask me and tell me, if you don't believe in life after death, then you aren't Christian. The main ideologists of Misha's government pretended to be big believers. If someone is Christian, taking into consideration my life and activities, I'm definitely one of them. I also respect our culture and religion. Religion saved our country and played a very important part in its history. All my kids were baptized and we obey all procedures. My wife and parents are more believers than I am. Nobody can call me an atheist. I always carry a cross."
I've read different quotes from him.
Yeah.
In like English language interviews that were, let's say, more sounding like an agnostic or an atheist speaking.
Yeah, he's a big believer in the Georgian Orthodox Church, but not a big believer in a supreme deity. But, I don't know. Georgians don't seem to be so bothered about that. Georgia's dislike for politicians who don't believe in God, at least in 2008, places it in third place of all countries surveyed, sandwiched right between Iraq at 87% and Iran with 75%, which means more people in Georgia believe that an atheist is unfit to lead the country than in Iran. The list is topped by Indonesia with 88%. Also close to Georgia, Turkey is at 55%. Ukraine is at 45%. In the West, not believing in God seems to be a little less of a deal breaker. Only 17.3% of Canadians believe it matters, compared to 11% of Germans and Spaniards, 13% of Australians. The U.S. is somewhat of an outlier among OECD countries with a fairly high 32%.
But I'm not aware of any successful U.S. leader who said, "I don't believe in all that religious stuff."
Mumbo jumbo, yeah, exactly. Yeah, there needs to be a certain amount of pandering to the, whatever. Well, one day we shall overcome. We here at tbilpod.com don't only cover Georgia and Georgian-related events and trends around the world, but are also deeply embedded in the hippest neighborhood in Tbilisi, that being Tatsminda. So, we wanted to mention that there is a really great, new, very small Lebanese restaurant run by two very nice Egyptian guys on Lahidze Street, number 6, the first block up from Rustaveli, 10 meters from the entrance of the conservatory and across the street from New Asia, Tbilisi's best Chinese restaurant. So for those on a mission for hummus, falafel, tabbouleh, and baba ganoush, stop by. Also, ask them about what's going on in Egypt right now, which is quite interesting to hear from them. This week's English language movies at the Rustaveli Movie Theater across from Parliament are on Saturday, the 6th of July, World War Z at 8:45. On Wednesday, the 10th, Monsters University at 8:45. Tickets are 10 lari and 50 tetri. No Kolga movies this week. Next week on Wednesday, the 10th of July at 6:15, Works in Progress will host Paul Crago from the U.S. Library of Congress, whose talk is entitled Political and Theological Aspects of the 17th of May 2013 events. Lecture will take place at Zandukeli, number 16, at the ISET CRRC building.
And from next week, Mark will really be on a road trip.
I will really, really be on a road trip, and I will be doing my best to figure out a way from that road trip how I can do this, but we'll come up with something. That's it for this week. My Twitter address is at TXTBUK. We'll be blogging the trip that I'm about to start on, so we'll let you know how that goes. Email is tbilpod, tblpod@gmail.com, or post to the forum on our website, www.tbilpod.com. And we will finish with Canned Heat from 1968, On the Road Again. We'll be right back.
on the road again. I'm on the road again. But I'm so tired of crying, but I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again. I ain't got no woman just to call my special friend. You know the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow, in the rain and snow. You know the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow, in the rain and snow. I didn't have no pharaoh, not even no place to go. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young, when I was quite young. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young, when I was quite young. She said, Lord, have mercy on my wicked son. Mama, please, don't you cry no more, don't you cry no more. Take a hint from me, mama, please, don't you cry no more, don't you cry no more. Cause it's soon one morning, down the road I'm gone. But I ain't going down that long old lonesome road all by myself. But I ain't going down that long old lonesome road all by myself. I can't carry you, baby, gonna carry somebody